I committed to the voters of Fulton County and the world for that matter that we will use every resource at our disposal to fight for their vote. We're using all resources against those who seek to take over our elections. I want to thank all of those from around the nation, legal minds in particular, who have volunteered their assistance because they know that this is bigger than just Fulton County, Georgia alone.
Well, on that point, he's absolutely right.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-round swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of The Bradcast. I got to tell you, I enjoyed Desi Doyen. Hi, Des.
Hi.
I enjoyed our few minutes talking about Bad Bunny on yesterday's show at the top of the show so much that before we get dragged into, oh, I don't know, the grimmer stuff like the release just before airtime of the affidavit used by the FBI to obtain their search warrant for last month's raid of the Fulton County Elections Facility outside of Atlanta, before we get to that, and before we get, frankly, to Desi Doyen's latest Green News report, which is
filled with fun,
always grim, right, and all that goes with that. By the way, spoiler alert on the FBI affidavit in Fulton County. If it was, even though it just broke before airtime, if there was anything really, really shocking, surprising, sexy, disturbing, I don't know, I'd probably lead the show with it, such as we are going to hold it off for a little bit. Well, it's either a tantalizing tease with fantastic stuff waiting ahead, or, yeah, it's not that impressive. You can stick around and find out which one is which. Before we get there, just a few more observations from the so-called culture wars, which we don't talk about a lot, but like I said, I did enjoy Bad Bunny. And of course, I say so-called culture wars because the entire idea, frankly, of a culture war is right-wing nonsense that I don't really understand why so many play into. They are in a war against culture. That part I get, but that's about it. Seems to me that there needs to be two sides in an actual war. And generally, I don't see the left taking part in any such war. It's just going on with its life. It's watching right-wingers protest whatever it is they don't like on any particular day and then being forced or sucked in, frankly, to defending something or other against idiotic, ginned-up outrage on Fox News.
Well, that is Fox News' business model.
It is. And what happens is Republicans, you know, end up spending time on that nonsense, running and campaigning on that idiocy instead of spending time on issues that actually matter, like things that are actually breaking this nation and this planet. That's why we have these so-called culture wars, so that Republicans don't have to deal with real stuff. But as far, so far as things go in that regard, that culture war, and in this corner of the right wing's long war against a free press, well, that has most recently culminated in, among other things, a bit of a right wing takeover of the legendary CBS News by Trump supporting billionaires who are attempting to rewire the news outlet in favor of MAGA, a network version of Fox News, if you will, or as close as they can actually get to pulling off something like that. That's what they're hoping. Recently, as you know, CBS's new owners, Skydance Paramount or Paramount Skydance or whatever the hell it's now called, they installed Barry Weiss, a libertarianish opinion writer who has no actual experience in television news. They installed her as the head of CBS News. She subsequently canceled a 60-minute expose on one of the torture prisons in El Salvador that the Trump administration unlawfully sent Venezuelan migrants to. She replaced the anchors of the CBS Evening News with a guy named Tony DuCopel, whose first few weeks in Walter Cronkite and Dan Rather's anchor chair have been, shall we say, a bit rocky. But now the first actual numbers are in for those first few weeks following last month's changes at the top of the CBS Evening News. And like pretty much everything that Trump touches in any way, shape, or form, like the Kennedy Center, for instance, which is now scheduled to be closed because nobody was willing to perform there or show up to watch the performances after Trump appended his name to John F. Kennedy's storied living memorial. Well, the just like that, kind of, the new extra Trumpy CBS Evening News now appears to be failing straight out of the gate as well. This, according to TV Insider, Tony DuCopel is only a month into his new role as CBS Evening News anchor, but the show is already losing viewers while its rivals on ABC and NBC continue to grow. According to Adweek, CBS Evening News ratings were down, way down, arguably, by 7% in total viewers and down 8% in the key demo of 25 to 54-year-olds in the last week of January. That as compared to the week prior when DuCopel was first stepping into the anchor chair. Apparently, people saw him and did not like him. CBS Evening News was also down year over year with a 6% drop in total viewers and a 9% drop in the key demo compared to the same week last year. Now, just in case you might want to say that it was a slow news week or something at the end of January, well, there really is. There's never a slow news week at this point in
exactly.
The Trump era. But more empirical evidence would suggest that the DuCopel dive had little to do with how busy the final week of January was in the news, because in that very same week, by comparison, ratings for ABC News Tonight with David Muir was actually up 3% in total viewers, 9% in the demo compared to the previous week. It was also up 11% in total viewers and 4% in the demo compared to the same week last year, year over year. Over on NBC, similar story. NBC Nightly News with Tom Lamas finished second behind ABC compared to the week prior. NBC's broadcast was also up. In their case, it was up 4% in total viewers, and in the demo, the show was up 3% in total viewers from the same week last year. So only CBS took a nosedive for some reason in the final weeks of week of January. We'll see if that continues. But yeah, initial, you know, baby steps to turn CBS into Fox News do not seem to be going well. Just another data point reminder that everything Trump touches in any way turns to, well, disaster and failure. Speaking of disaster and failure in the so-called culture war, and since I can't stop talking about Bad Bunny at the Super Bowl, after Trump decided to throw a fit because American citizen and U.S. resident and the world's most streamed musical artist, Bad Bunny, was to headline the Super Bowl halftime show, resulting in a pathetic alternate halftime show featuring a whole bunch of nobodies and has-beens produced by the right-wing Turning Point USA outfit. After all was said and done, and Bad Bunny literally brought down the house in his brilliant celebratory performance, that frankly resembled one of those fantastic Olympic opening ceremony sequences.
It did.
More than a Super Bowl halftime show.
Yeah, way more.
with Trump calling it nonetheless the worst halftime show ever and complaining that nobody could understand a word he was saying. Bad Bunny sang in Spanish, which only about 635 million people in the world are able to understand. But sure, Brad, but how about the U.S.? Well, as it turns out, only 45 million speak Spanish in the U.S. Why, that's virtually nobody. Anyway, despite all that nonsense, as Oliver Willis observed yesterday at Daily Kos, after all was said and done on Sunday night, and some of Trump's biggest supporters actually bothered to watch the Big Bunny halftime spectacular, well, a number of them realized, hey, that guy's pretty good. When Bad Bunny was first announced as the halftime show performer this past September, notes Willis, right-wingers lashed out. Trump kept that momentum going on Sunday, declaring that the performance was, quote, an affront to the greatness of America. His unofficial advisor, the loony Laura Loomer, was even more explicit. She wrote, quote, this isn't white enough for me. Well, at least she said it out loud.
There you go.
But so-called conservative pundit Meghan McCain had a different point of view. She wrote on social media, quote, I'm sorry, but I just genuinely question your taste level if you didn't enjoy the Bad Bunny halftime show. British TV host and frequent Trump booster Piers Morgan said he, quote, absolutely loved, unquote, the performance and ranked it among the best in Super Bowl history. And the Manosphere podcast host, Andrew Schultz, who backed Trump but has become more of a critic lately, also said that the halftime show was, quote, objectively incredible, unquote. Even white nationalist Nick Fuentes, Hitler-loving Nick Fuentes, and I don't say that as an insult, he calls himself Hitler-loving, even he wrote, quote, I like the halftime show. I thought it was fun. Willis notes Bad Bunny's performance also caused a rupture between influencer brothers Logan and Jake Paul. They've been part of the pro-Trump media world for some time. Jake Paul told his followers to turn off Bad Bunny's performance. He called him, quote, fake American citizen. Bad Bunny, of course, is from Puerto Rico, which is U.S. territory, which makes him a native-born American. But never mind that, you know, facts and stuff. Responding, however, to his brother, Logan Paul wrote, quote, I love my brother, but I don't agree with this. He said, Puerto Ricans are Americans, and I'm happy they were given the opportunity to showcase the talent that comes from the island. Wow. So, yeah. Even a few cracks in the culture wars over on the MAGA side, it seems, which probably means they'll be, shooting at each other in that war soon enough, if the usual pattern on the right holds up.
It's really telling to me that, you know, some of the folks on the right found it to be a great performance that they really enjoyed, while others saw the message that Bad Bunny was promoting. Remember the big sign that said the only thing more powerful than hate is love?
Yeah.
That they saw that message and understood it and then translated that into an attack on them.
Well, there you go. And they felt that they
some
had
did,
to.
Some did, some didn't. But they had to speak up about that.
Well, and they had to, you know, sort of stand behind their guy, stand behind their president who said this is the worst Super Bowl ever. But some of them had a little trouble doing even that. In fact, over on Fox News, while some allies, you know, of Trump's tried to hold the Trump line, not everyone was willing to play fully along. As this clip featuring Fox pundit Kaylee McGee White, whoever the hell she is, she held the line on the afternoon show called the Faulkner Focus. She held the line for the president. She was promoting that alternative halftime show, you know, where the real Americans were watching. And they were on Monday. They were still trying to promote this alternative show, even if the host, Harris Faulkner, was not willing to play along entirely with Kaylee McGee White.
Yeah, well, and it's also the family-friendly choice to tune into Turning Point's alternative. You know, much has been made about the fact that Bad Bunny sang solely in Spanish, but the fact is, Harris, he wouldn't have been able to sing his lyrics in English because they are so profane and vulgar that the FCC would have pulled the show entirely. So this, again, was the family-friendly option, and I think that a lot of people watched Bad Bunny's performance and they saw, okay, he celebrates his heritage, he celebrates his culture, but why is everyone else in the world allowed to do that except for us? This was a uniquely American event, and we aren't allowed to celebrate our own culture, our own heritage in the 250th anniversary of our country. I think that says a lot about the NFL.
Well, Charlie Puth sang beautifully our nation's anthem, and then that gorgeous military flyover. I mean, there were a lot of moments for people to take in that were pro-American. But then what you just described was going on, too.
Yeah, so there was some really, really nice stuff. But also what that nonsense that you just said, that was true, too.
And we're not allowed to do all this stuff, except you just did it.
And we aren't allowed to celebrate America at the Super Bowl. Yeah, too bad. There's so little celebration of America going on. That's why I was glad actually Faulkner jumped in and said, well, we did have a flyover of, you know, six military jets. Now, the part where she said that his lyrics are so profane that if they were in English, the FCC wouldn't allow them, I'm going to go ahead and rate that true, because that is true. But hey, if nobody could understand a word the guy said, what are you so worried about? Why is it family friendly to not watch? Nobody could understand him anyway, right? As Willis notes, most Americans, and clearly even many MAGA types, simply enjoyed a well-executed and unifying performance oriented around American diversity. The Super Bowl controversy, which he puts in quotes, is another moment where Trump, Republicans, and many in the right-wing movement find themselves far outside of the norm, preferring hate and division over unity. And yes, as Bad Bunny said, the only thing more powerful than hate is love. And speaking of those dangerous criminal migrants who we must deport at all costs, even though Bad Bunny is not one of them, he's an American citizen, born and raised in Puerto Rico. As even Trump-friendly CBS News is reporting today in an exclusive, they note that of nearly 400,000 immigrants now arrested by Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Trump's first year back in the White House, less than 14% of them had charges, much less convictions, for violent criminal offenses, according to an internal Department of Homeland Security document obtained by CBS News. Yes, these are the violent, so-called worst of the worst criminals that need to be rounded up. Even if American citizens get shot dead by immigration officers in the process, these people are so bad that we just, you know, hey, a few Americans die in the bargain, so be it. We're getting the worst of the worst off the streets. Well, 14% of them, anyway, are actually violent criminals, according to DHS's own numbers. The official statistics contained in the DHS document, which had not previously been reported publicly, provide the most detailed look yet into who ICE has arrested during the administration's far-reaching deportation operations across the U.S. CBS notes the internal DHS figures undermine frequent assertions by the Trump administration that its crackdown on illegal immigration is primarily targeting dangerous and violent criminals living in the U.S. illegally. Apparently not so. While Trump and his aides often talk about immigration officials targeting murderers, rapists, and gangsters, the internal data indicate that less than 2% of those arrested by ICE over the past year had homicide or sexual assault charges or convictions. Another 2% of those taken into ICE custody were accused of being gang members. Accused, meaning what? Meaning that they had tattoos, some of which said, I love mom, or, you know, commemorating their brother who suffers from autism. In any event, less than 2%. were these, you know, wild, dangerous gangs. The ICE arrests, notes CBS, involved individuals accused of belonging to gangs like Tren de Aragua, a criminal organization with origins in Venezuela's prisons. Mr. Trump initially made the gang a focal point in his crackdown, deporting more than 200 men who were accused of being Tren de Aragua members to a notorious prison in El Salvador. A CBS News and 60 Minutes investigation last year, you know, the one that Barry Weiss held off from broadcast on 60 Minutes or canceled just hours before airtime, held it off for about a month. That investigation found that most of those men did not have any apparent criminal record. Most of them. Nearly 40% of all of those who have been arrested by ICE in Trump's first year back in office were only accused of civil immigration offenses like living in the U.S. illegally or overstaying their permission to be in the country, you know, like Elon Musk did. Have they rounded up Elon Musk just yet? Please hurry. Those alleged violations of U.S. immigration law, by the way, are typically adjudicated by Justice Department immigration judges in civil, not criminal proceedings. Yes, overstaying your visa, even coming across the border, you know, secretly in the middle of the night, that's a civil violation, not a criminal violation. Added up together, the number of ICE arrests involving individuals charged with or convicted of violent crimes represents around just 13.9% of all of those arrests. The data in the DHS document does not include arrests by Border Patrol agents who the Trump administration has deployed to places far away from the actual U.S.-Mexico border, like Los Angeles or Chicago and Minneapolis. In those cities, Border Patrol agents have undertaken aggressive and sweeping arrest operations targeting day laborers at Home Depot parking lots and stopping people, including U.S. citizens, to question them about their immigration status. So, if you include the Border Patrol arrest numbers, the percentage of actual violent criminals arrested by ICE and CBP together is likely even smaller than 13.9%. Y'all have been had. Y'all who thought that Donald Trump was, you know, rounding up the worst of the worst, because they still say that day in, day out. And if you criticize ICE, oh, I guess you're in favor of child rapists. No, I voted against Donald Trump, but that's a separate story. At the same time, CBS also notes that while Trump's deportation program enjoyed majority support during the 2024 campaign, and in his early months in office, public opposition to his crackdown has now grown significantly because of concerns about agents' tactics in cities like Minneapolis and over who is actually being swept up by their operations. A CBS News poll last month found that Americans' support for Trump's deportation efforts had now fallen in this poll to 46%. That's down from almost 59% at the start of his second term. Just over 60% of those surveyed said immigration agents were being, quote, too tough. But of course, don't see this as racist. Don't see this as part of the pretend culture wars. It's all just, you know, based on keeping Americans safe from those dangerous and violent and the worst of the worst migrants in our country, right? It's not based on racism. If so, well, then the weird way that the Department of Justice has created its so-called Religious Liberty Commission is kind of harder to explain if this isn't a racist thing, after all. A handful of faith organizations have now teamed up to sue the Trump administration for the lack of religious diversity on the Justice Department's Religious Liberty Commission. A commission, I guess, that was, you know, brought together to ensure that there would be religious freedom across the country. Well, I guess religious freedom, it depends which religion you're talking about, apparently. The lawsuit, according to TPM's Nicole LaFond, was filed in the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York on Monday. The plaintiffs include Interfaith Alliance, the group's president and CEO, Reverend Paul Rauschenbusch, as well as Muslims for Progressive Values, the Sikh American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and Hindus for Human Rights. Well, you can see where this is going. Weird that, you know, why would you want to include them in a religious liberty commission? Why would they especially be included in such a commission, to be frank? Of course they should be included, but they're not. And, of course, there's a reason. The group of faith organizations are asking the court to, quote, declare that the commission was created and administered in violation of federal law, to require the disclosure of documents that should already be public from this commission, and to ensure that any recommendations produced by this body are clearly identified as coming from an unlawfully constituted commission, says Interfaith Alliance in their statement on Monday. By the way, the Trump DOJ's Religious Liberty Commission, while not including any Muslims or Sikhs or Hindus, it does include Protestants and Catholic Christians, as well as a rabbi.
Oh, a whole rabbi?
Yes, a whole rabbi.
Wow.
I think it's a whole rabbi. But that's it. As far as apparently religious people go. However, it also includes a former Miss California. Explain that one. Also, explain this one. It also includes Dr. Phil.
What?
Yeah, I know. That's what I thought when I saw it. Okay. Quote, the religious freedom for some is religious freedom for none. The group's leader said in a statement, adding the government has no right to pick and choose which religious beliefs to promote and which to marginalize. The Trump administration has failed to uphold our country's proud religious freedom tradition, and we will hold them accountable. Today's lawsuit is our recommitment to fight for religious liberty for all with every tool available to us, the Rauschenbusch said in the statement. Good. Go get him. And by the way, all of this comes amid an administration that came into office pretending to give a damn about anti-Semitism. Oh, they were so upset. They, you know, filed lawsuits against universities and colleges claiming that it was to hold them accountable for the anti-Semitic practices on their campuses. And now, while it should go without saying by now, don't believe a word of that crap. I hope to talk about this more in the coming days, if the news and the radio gods are with me, about GOP, MAGA, anti-Semitism. Because, you know, while anti-Semitism was a huge topic for Republicans when they were, you know, yelling and screaming about it during campus protests against Israel's war on Gaza, even in recent months, particularly since the murder of Charlie Kirk, well, what we have seen is, you know, that whole idea has sort of been blown out of the water. You know, this notion that Republicans give a damn about anti-Semitism, that idea has just been blown out of the water. It's nonsense. But I'll get to that on another day. Don't have time for that now. Finally, from culture wars to racism to just out and out corruption with these people, you've likely heard by now that that Donald Trump has been trying to hold up construction on the Hudson Gateway River Tunnels project, the largest ongoing infrastructure project in the nation right now. It was first begun by Barack Obama during his administration. It was then finalized under Joe Biden to build a new, much-needed tunnel system under the Hudson River connecting New York and New Jersey by car and rail, etc. Well, Trump was vowing to hold up that project, to basically stop that project, unless Chuck Schumer agreed to name both D.C.'s Dulles Airport and New York's Penn Station after Donald Trump, which, by the way, apparently Congress has no authority to even do, even if they wanted to, which I'm fairly sure Chuck Schumer does not want to. More than 1,000 construction workers would be out of a job if Trump had his way, if he's able to shut down this project. Anyway, the latest on that in our Green News Report a little bit later. But in a related-ish news item today in the Trump-era nexus between, I guess, river crossings and unbridled corruption by the president of the United States, in yet another bullying move, this time against Canada, Donald Trump has made wild threats on social media to bar the opening of the soon-to-be-completed Gordie Howe International Bridge connecting Detroit and Windsor, Canada. Gordie Howe, a great NFL hockey player. In what Morning Memo's David...
NHL.
What did I say?
NFL.
Oh, is that an NFL hockey player? Oh, I need a day off. Anyway, yes, NHL hockey player. In what Morning Memo's David Kurtz describes as a Mad King diatribe, and that's kind of where we are here at this point with this guy, Trump said, quote, "I will not allow this bridge to open until the United States is fully compensated for everything we have given them," I guess Canada, "and also, importantly, Canada treats the United States with the fairness and respect that we deserve." The hell is this guy talking about? The New York Times story on the threats contains this very important note, which may answer what's really going on here. They report that the nearby Ambassador Bridge, one of the busiest border crossings on the continent, has been privately owned for decades by a Detroit trucking industry billionaire and his family, the Marounds, I think is how you pronounce it. The family had previously called on Donald Trump to halt the construction of the Gordie Howe Bridge, which would, once open, compete for the more than $300 million in daily cross-border trade over the Ambassador Bridge. Well, imagine that. I guess we get it now. Makes sense, doesn't it? On social media, Trump took things a little further with an extortion threat, notes Kurtz. Trump's price for opening the Canadian-built and paid-for bridge, the U.S., quote, "should own perhaps at least one half of this asset."
At least one half.
So they built it. They paid for it. It's going to make life better for us, easier to get goods from Canada, easier for us to travel to Canada. But now Trump says, well, if they give us half of it, we'll take it. He didn't mention whether or not he would demand that it be called the Donald J. Trump Gordie Howe Bridge or not. But yeah, give it a minute.
And, you know, just about a couple minutes ago,
yeah,
New York Times put out an alert saying the billionaire owner of a bridge in Detroit met with a Trump official just hours before the president announced his diatribe against the bridge.
Unbelievable corruption right before our very eyes, to the point that no one even knows what to do because these people don't even hide it. You don't need investigative journalists anymore. They're just doing the corruption right in front of your face. Although, in truth, if this is what they are doing in front of your face, imagine what we don't yet know about what they're actually doing behind closed doors. Anyway, let's take a quick break. We will pick up with, the breaking news that picks up on my conversation yesterday with Georgia voting system expert Marilyn Marks regarding the FBI raid of the Fulton County, Georgia elections warehouse outside of Atlanta, which took hundreds of thousands of ballots and other materials from the 2020 election that the sore loser Donald Trump is still pretending that he won in Georgia. Fulton County sued to get the ballots back, and a Trump-appointed judge on the case ordered the government to release the affidavit that was used to obtain the search warrant that the FBI used to take those ballots from the Fulton County warehouse. That affidavit just released before airtime today. We'll have details on that right after this. Plus, the Green News Report coming up a bit later. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast.
Hey. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Desi Doyen, maybe we ought to just move the whole show to Georgia at this point.
No thanks.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Why, you got something against Georgia? It's beautiful down there.
It is a lovely, lovely state.
All right,
state. This
yeah.
is true.
All right.
But the humidity is brutal.
All right, that's true, it is. Did I say welcome back to the Bradcast? In
you
any
just
event,
did.
Welcome back again. As noted yesterday, we had a detailed conversation with longtime election and voting system expert Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance. If you missed that show, you can and should download it for free at bradblog.com. Thanks to donors like you. Marilyn is an expert not only in voting systems, but specifically voting systems in the state of Georgia, where she successfully sued some years ago to decertify the state's entire statewide voting system that was run at the time on unverifiable touchscreen voting systems made by Diebold. Sadly, instead of replacing those systems in 2020 with a verifiable hand-marked paper ballot system, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger ignored that advice from experts, and he replaced the old Diebold systems with similarly insecure, unverifiable touchscreen systems made by a company named Dominion just before the 2020 election. And now, well, all of us have to pay for the problems that come with him having done that. Now, Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden in Georgia, along with several other battleground states back in 2020. He lost in Georgia by a very narrow margin of about 12,000 votes or so, when he famously tried to strong-arm Raffensperger in that recorded phone call to, quote, find enough ballots to flip the state from Biden to Trump. A felony, by the way, for which Trump was eventually indicted. But last month, Trump's FBI suddenly showed up at the Fulton County Elections Warehouse outside of Atlanta with a search warrant to haul off all of the ballots and other materials from that election in 2020, with the warrant citing potential violations of voting fraud laws and the federal law mandating the retention of all election materials for 22 months after an election. Well, we are now 5 years after that 2020 election, so it's unclear what crimes, if there actually were any in Fulton County that year, would not already be too late to charge outside of the 5-year statute of limitations. Nonetheless, Fulton County officials, after being raided by Donald Trump's FBI and having all of that material taken from them, hundreds of thousands of ballots and more, they want to get their election materials back, especially since there are a number of civil lawsuits that are still underway regarding that election that are, you know, filed in federal court and in state court as well, I believe. And they need that material now that the chain of custody, frankly, has been entirely lost thanks to this raid by the FBI taking all of that material. So they filed in federal court to get those all that material back. And in the bargain, the Trump-appointed federal judge assigned to oversee this case instructed the Department of Justice to release the full affidavit that was used to convince a federal magistrate judge to sign the search warrant. And that the federal judge overseeing this Fulton County case said that the affidavit used to obtain that search warrant must be released by 5 p.m. on Tuesday. Well, the DOJ has now done so, and I'll get to it momentarily, but it was that affidavit that Marilyn and I discussed, among other things, yesterday regarding what might be in it, what new information we did not already know about long ago that might have encouraged the federal magistrate judge to sign a warrant under the premise, you know, that it was needed to stop some sort of an ongoing crime? Well, apparently that federal magistrate judge does not listen to the broadcast, because it seems like everything in this affidavit is stuff that we have covered on this show long ago. I admittedly, I read it very quickly before airtime, but I can largely confirm the New York Times coverage of the affidavit's release, which goes this way: an FBI search warrant affidavit unsealed on Tuesday shows that a criminal investigation into 2020 election results in Fulton County, Georgia, was set off by a leading election denier in the Trump administration, and it relied heavily on claims about ballots that have been widely debunked. The unsealing of the affidavit in Fulton County is likely to raise more questions about the Trump administration's use of the FBI and Justice Department to revive old, largely disproven claims about the 2020 election in the state, which Trump narrowly lost, according to the Times. The affidavit notes, quote, the FBI criminal investigation originated from a referral sent by Kurt Olson, presidentially appointed director of election security and integrity. Who knew we even had one of those? The Times notes that Olson played a central role in Trump's attempt to overturn, in other words, his attempt to steal the 2020 election, including speaking to the president multiple times on January 6, 2021. Now, to be fair, Donald Trump did have a lot of free time on his hands that day when he wasn't doing anything else. But Olson, like Trump, has continued to push false claims about elections and was recently appointed to the key role in the Trump administration. Now, never mind who actually compiled this material or has their name on it, this material in this affidavit that was used to obtain a search warrant. What new claims or evidence was in it that we haven't known about for years, that we haven't already discussed multiple times on this program over the years since 2020, including on yesterday's program with Marilyn Marks, where we detailed, once again, the mess in Democratic-leaning Fulton County, as overseen by Republican Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, as ballots in Fulton were tallied three different times after the election to try and basically appease the president, who was already claiming that it was stolen from him. Now, those three different counts actually came up with three different results. All the results showed Joe Biden winning pretty easily, very easily, over Donald Trump, but they were not exactly the same in each count. Nonetheless, Raffensperger signed off on all of it. As Marilyn noted yesterday and during many previous appearances on the show, while the initial count and then the hand audit and then the official recount was carried out, that recount was carried out on the same computer tabulators that had initially counted them, it was all done very sloppily. It differed by several thousands of votes. For example, both Trump and Biden received more votes in the final count than they did originally. I think Trump received another 1,000 votes or something. But there didn't seem to be any sort of evidence of some sort of fraud scheme to steal the elections, nor any evidence that Donald Trump actually won the election in Georgia, much less had it stolen from him. Now, I didn't see anything particularly new or disturbing in my admittedly very quick read of this 22-page affidavit that was released just before airtime this afternoon. But as far as I can tell, neither has Georgia's Atlanta Journal-Constitution or, as a matter of fact, as I've been speaking to you here, who is it? The Washington Post, breaking news: FBI cited debunked claims to obtain warrant for Fulton County voting records, documents show. So the Washington Post didn't find anything, nor did the New York Times coverage, which continues, quote, many of the claims in the affidavit refer to long-held and consistently debunked conspiracy theories about elections in Georgia, including arguments about fraudulent and duplicate absentee ballots. election machine tabulators, tabulator tapes, and missing ballot images. Now, we've discussed really all of those issues on the show. There doesn't appear to be any sort of evidence of fraudulent ballots in the count. There were some ballots that were scanned more than once, though it's unclear whether all of them were actually counted more than once or if they were just rescanned, as is sometimes needed, so they're not necessarily counted twice. We discussed some weeks ago the claim that Fulton County officials failed to sign the tabulator tapes that were printed out by the tabulators on about 350,000 votes that were tallied on Election Day in what appears to have been an administrative error as opposed to evidence of 350,000 fraudulent ballots. And we've discussed the fact that ballot images, the digital photographs, if you will, of the actual ballots that are taken at the moment that they are scanned by the tabulators, that many of those ballot images were actually deleted rather than saved. That's actually the practice, sadly, in many parts of the country. I would say most parts of the country. Even if in Georgia they are supposed to retain those ballot images. But Raffensperger apparently forgot to include that notice in his orders to election officials across the state. But if there was anything new or different in the affidavit released on Tuesday that we didn't know about before, frankly, I don't know yet what it is. It looked like the same stuff we've known about, we've covered here for years now. A bigger problem may be that the FBI's raid broke the chain of custody for all of those election materials, despite the ongoing civil suits. A problem that was cited by the Fulton County Board of Commissioners chair, Rob Pitts, last week when he announced that the county's was suing to get their election materials back after the FBI and DOJ failed to give local officials an inventory of what was taken. They just took it. Quote, "We don't even have copies of what they took, so it's a problem," Pitt said. The county estimated the FBI seized 656 boxes of, quote, original documents and records from the 2020 election. That according to the motion to unseal that affidavit, but another official estimated the number was closer to 700 boxes. At least 11 lawsuits challenging the 2020 election results in Georgia have been filed, according to Fulton County court records. None of them have proved that there was widespread fraud or malfeasance. And yet here we are, more than 5 years later, after the statute of limitations and Donald Trump's FBI is raiding the place, taking the boxes, not leaving a receipt, blowing up the chain of custody for this material, even while there are ongoing civil suits. Democrats and election officials across the country have been monitoring what's going on in Fulton County with apprehension, according to the Times, as some worry that Trump might direct the Justice Department to search election centers in other cities or counties as well. Elections have long been conducted by state authorities with minimal involvement from the federal government. As a matter of fact, I don't know of any case where they have come in and raided an entire county's ballots, certainly not 5 years later. Last week, Trump called in a podcast interview for the Republican Party to, quote, nationalize elections, which he has no authority to do. He later told reporters in the Oval Office that the federal government should get in, quote, should get involved in elections. He cited a list of cities, all urban centers that voted against him with large minority populations like Detroit, Philadelphia, Atlanta, where he claimed, without evidence, that there was voter fraud back in 2020. There is no evidence of widespread fraud in any of those places, not in all of these years. And I'm sorry to have to keep reporting it, but as long as he's going to keep complaining about it and pretending, well, I'll have to keep rebutting it, I guess. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution notes that Trump last week promised that the raid would unveil answers to lingering mysteries about the heavily Democratic county's election conduct, noting on former FBI director, Deputy Director Dan Bongino's podcast last week, quote, "You're going to see something in Georgia where they were able to get with the court order and the ballots. You're going to see some interesting things come out." which of course is Trump speak for I have no idea what is going to come out.
True.
But if I tell you something interesting is going to come out, you'll believe me. And even if I'm proven wrong, why, I'll just bomb another country, or I'll send an immigration goon, to another American city so you don't notice it as much. But we will see. That's what we know for now about all of this. And of this afternoon, it does not appear to be anything more than we knew about Georgia's 2020 election when this week started. We will, of course, continue to follow some interesting things coming out of Georgia as soon as they come out. All right, Desi Doyen and the Green News Report are next. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Please consider supporting whichever progressive media outlet is serving you. Most, just like us, do not receive corporate or political support. We all need your support to counter the powerful corporate media echo chamber. From Desi Doyen and myself, thank you. And we both start and end with Bad Bunny today, so
yes. That's
a good day.
Uh-huh.
On our latest Green News Report.
God bless America!
Bad Bunny's Super Bowl Power Play. Court rules Energy Department's climate science denier group violated federal law. Plus,
it prohibits the president from withholding money already allocated to the project.
Judge blocks Trump's blockade of funding for a major New York tunnel project.
All of those blockades and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
You know, it's very warm here today. High in New York today, 30 degrees. In L.A., it was 88 degrees. It even... I'm not sure we should be happy about the end of the world, but it's nice.
Yes, it is nice. For us, today, this is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen, I know the rest of the country has been suffering. It was a beautiful weekend out here on the West Coast. A lovely day for football.
Yes, it was. And you know, the Super Bowl can serve as a snapshot of the cultural zeitgeist in America. And unlike previous Super Bowl broadcasts, the 2026 broadcast had zero commercials dedicated to promoting electric vehicles.
Really?
For the first time in years.
No kidding.
And that probably reflects the Trump administration's broadside attack on EVs, rolling back electric vehicle rebates, incentives, and funding for a national EV charging network.
And the fact that great big companies don't want to upset the president.
Yep. And interestingly, there was a flood of Super Bowl ads touting the forced adoption of artificial intelligence in the U.S. But those did not mention that the proliferation of AI data centers is a primary driver of skyrocketing electricity rates across the country.
So the rates going up, we're using more energy, but we're not selling any cars that might solve the problem.
Nope. And also, in that joyous halftime show, rap star and U.S. citizen Bad Bunny of Puerto Rico featured a key moment with workers on power poles, highlighting the prevalence of power outages in Puerto Rico as its rickety grid is increasingly exposed to more frequent extreme storms and hurricanes, like Hurricane Maria in 2017, that have battered the island's power system, which is still suffering from lack of federal investment. Dallas meteorologist Ryan Jones connected that same need for investment and upgrades to build resilience into the nation's electric grid in the climate era.
It's not just Puerto Rico. This is a possibility that many families are facing across the U.S. as storms get stronger. And after seeing Bad Bunny's Super Bowl performance last night, it showed that long-term power outages aren't just an experience, but it's a story. It's a story of people that deal with this time and time again. And those stories matter.
Yeah, well, just throw them a roll of paper towels.
Puerto Rico's electric grid still desperately needs investment. But in the past year, Trump Energy Secretary Chris Wright canceled 80% of a $1 billion fund for upgrading and repairing the island's grid. In other news, a federal judge ruled that Secretary Chris Wright also violated federal law when he secretly selected five prominent climate science deniers to churn out an agency report casting doubt on mainstream climate science. He bypassed federal transparency requirements. Mainstream climate scientists shredded and debunked that error-filled report. EPA Chief Lee Zeldin hopes to use that science deniers report as justification for repealing the EPA's endangerment finding, a landmark scientific determination that climate warming emissions endanger human health, which provides the legal foundation for federal climate regulations. However, that scheme to repeal the scientific endangerment finding has hit a snag.
Good.
The official announcement of the massive rollback has reportedly been stalled in the Trump White House over fears that the climate science deniers' report is, quote, too weak to withstand a court challenge.
Yeah, I should say so.
Finally, some good news.
Good.
The Trump administration halted $16 billion in funding for the Gateway Tunnels Project, a massive tunnel connecting New York and New Jersey, now under construction. Donald Trump reportedly told Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer that he would release those funds if Washington's Dulles Airport and New York's Penn Station are renamed after him.
Well, I just don't think Loser International Airport and Pathetic Penn Station would be very good names.
However, late last week, a federal judge in Manhattan temporarily reversed Trump's funding blockade, allowing construction to resume and agreeing with the states who sued and called the move an unlawful attempt to punish political rivals.
Well, that is putting it nicely. Donald Trump loses again. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, especially Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Hey, aquí el calor es diferente. El sol está ahí, no. Hey. La capital del perreo, ahora todos quieren ser latino. No, ey, pero le falta sazón.
Yeah. Don't worry, no one can understand a word he's saying, right? Which, unfortunately, maybe some can. Therefore, we can't use any more of that song that we've already
True.
Run there, Des.
Yeah, that would be a major, probably major FCC violation.
Yeah, nobody at the FCC speaks Spanish either. So, all right, we got to get out. Thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download all of them for free at bradblog.com to share it with folks you know, love, and hate. You can, while you're there, please do consider hitting a donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves until the FCC notices us. And what else? That's it. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you'll find me at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.